So we have a unique session today with three speakers but four presentations. So I'll introduce our three speakers. Dr. Hall received his PhD, Dr. Charlie Hall that is, received his PhD in biostatistics from Johns Hopkins under the direction of Scott Zegger and Karen Bandine Roche. After 6 years at the University of Connecticut, he moved to the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in 2001, where he has primarily worked in the Einstein Aging Study and the World Trade Center Health Program at the Fire Department of the City of New York. Dr. Hall has made major contributions through his application of change point methodology to problems in both these areas, some of which he will present this afternoon. Dr. James Cohn is Medical Director of the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. He's been in occupational health for 30 years in academia, local, state, and private practice. And I hear he's a really nice person to work with. And Dr. Maris Weber is the Director of the World Trade Center Epidemiology for the Fire Department of New York City and Professor of Epidemiology and Population Health at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. So we'll do each presentation and take questions after each.
Thank you. I submitted two abstracts figuring that one of them would get accepted, and I managed to get them both accepted in the same session. So problems you like to have, I guess. So the first talk is weight gain and lung function recovery in World Trade Center rescue recovery workers. Actually, I should keep an eye on the time here. How long do I have?
20 minutes. I'll give you a 5 minute.
Oh, great. Thank you. Okay. So first, a little bit of background for anybody who is not familiar with the issue here. There you see one of the many aerial photographs taken of dust cloud immediately after the fall of the towers on September 11th, 2001. There are no photographs from inside the dust cloud because there was no light. But there you can see, that is a 74-story building there, so you can see how huge it was. Here we have a partial list of some of the things that were found in the dust, sampled shortly thereafter, and you can see they are things that you really don't want to be breathing in. Many of them are carcinogens, and we've actually done research. There have been at least three papers published by the different groups on showing elevated incidence of cancer, but this is about pulmonary function. Thousands of rescue recovery workers were exposed to this dust cloud, and most rescue recovery workers from the Fire Department of the City of New York experienced substantial decline in pulmonary function during the first year after 9/11/2001. We set up a monitoring program a few weeks later, and people came in mostly in the first 6 months afterwards. We were fortunate that about 5 years earlier, the regular health services at the fire department had started taking regular pulmonary function tests, so we actually know what the pre-morbid levels were. And on average, there's been little recovery. We published a paper about 5 years ago, and we have another paper that's under review that will continue to show that. A small number have actually shown some improvement, and others have continued to experience substantial decline. And the purpose of this research is to investigate reasons for this heterogeneity. It would be very interesting to find out why is it that some people actually have improved, in rare cases, all the way back to pre-mortem levels, and what are the things that are causing continued very substantial decline far more than average. So this is a spaghetti plot. That is actually the technical statistical term. It is the trajectories of pulmonary function of a random sample of 50 rescue recovery workers from the fire department. The y-axis here is the forced expectancy. Expiratory volume in 1 second, a pulmonary function measure. I'll describe more clearly in a moment. And you can see, here we go. You can see right around the time of the exposure, there was a huge drop. Didn't matter whether you started high or started low, you had a big drop. And for the most part, there's a continued gradual decline. But some people seem to be getting a little better towards the end of this follow-up period, and some people can seem to be getting unusually worse. The study cohort for this particular analysis is 5,515 male firefighters from the fire department. We excluded women because I think there were only about 12 women active duty FDNY firefighters on 9/11. They have to have arrived at the site by 9/24/2001, about 2 weeks later. Consented to research, known smoking status and weight information, at least one pulmonary function test before the exposure, at least one pulmonary function test within the first year after the exposure, and one after 9/11/2001, at least 8 years after the exposure, so we can look at long-term effects. Gotta be careful here. We also excluded those with very large changes of weight, particularly weight loss. Extreme weight loss is probably associated with other conditions such as cancer, and that's not what we're looking for here. We're looking at people who don't have other major non-pulmonary comorbidities. The numbers, I believe, was 101 were excluded because they had extremes of weight gain or loss. We had over 50,000 pulmonary function tests, median of 10 per individual over this follow-up period. The fire department firefighters are mostly white. As of 9/11, they were roughly 39 years old, but a wide range, as you can see. They tend, on active duty, they tend to be healthy young men with higher BMI that is not necessarily indicative of obesity in the usual sense. If you measure the BMI of National Football League linemen, they will all be about 40 with almost zero body fat. These aren't quite that shape, but they generally tend to be active young men. Large follow-up for this analysis. The majority had retired by the end of their follow-up, so they didn't need to be as active as they were when they were there. And here you have the exposure based on the arrival time, which has been shown to be associated with numerous respiratory conditions. About 16% were actually there the morning that the towers came down, and most of the rest arrived the afternoon or the next day. There were a number of comorbidities. As you can see, there was a huge increase in asthma, moderate increases in chronic bronchitis, large increase in sinusitis. We're actually we've actually just submitted two papers on rhinosinusitis. Large increase in GERD, which we have not really looked at a lot. Large increase in cancer, but the numbers are still relatively small. Interestingly, we don't have a lot of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in the sense of usual diagnosis, COPD, and almost all of them are smokers, as to be expected. And fortunately, very little interstitial lung disease. FEV1 is forced expiratory volume one second. Take a spirometer, blow into it as much hard as you can. And the amount of air that comes through in 1 second, that's the measurement. So we defined three categories. We've also done analyses where we looked at this measure as a continuous measure. It is a nice continuous measure, but we're interested in looking at what are the things that are associated with significant decline or with actual improvement, because improvement was relatively rare. So you see those definitions there. The median decline was 390 milliliters between the first and last pulmonary function test after the exposure. And you can see we have modest numbers who fit the improved or substantial decline classifications. And the median time follow-up is 12.1 years, and you can see the statistics there. For weight gain, typically, people gain as they grow older. I certainly have. I used to be really thin. I'm not anymore. You see that roughly the majority gain 30 pounds or loops. The majority gain 30 pounds or less, and some gained over 30 pounds, and a few actually lost or stayed the same. This is probably because we have a very active cohort. Firefighters have to stay in shape. Most firefighters don't smoke. Many fire departments don't even permit smokers to get into the fire department. We actually do permit it. We try to get people to quit. We actually have had some success there. So you can see current smokers by the end of the cohort were down to 3%. The analyses are logistic regressions. Separate logistic regressions were the outcomes of improvement or substantial decline. The predictor of interest is weight gain, and we have included as predictors many other things that are believed to be associated with pulmonary function, including the initial decline from before the exposure to shortly after the exposure. And because smoking is such a huge predictor, we also did secondary analyses restricted to people who had never smoked. So the results, weight gain is associated with both being able to improve and not and declining. Specifically, if you gain weight, you are less likely to have improved, and you are more likely to have had a substantial decline. This is after controlling for the effect of smoking. People who quit smoking, and as you saw, a lot of people did quit smoking, that is associated with weight gain. This is including smoking in the model. Other things that were not our primary outcomes, the effect of the decline from immediately before to immediately after exposure was highly significant, and this may be a type of regression, the mean effect. The more you declined as immediately after the exposure, the less you declined further on. Interestingly, your acute exposure when you arrived at the site was not associated with either improvement or substantial decline, and neither was race or ethnic group. Smoking, interestingly, was very strongly associated with having a substantial decline. It was not really associated with improving. That might be a power issue because there are very few smokers, but there was no hint of a dose response for the improvement. We restricted the analysis for never smokers, and we got almost exactly the same results. For every 10 pounds of weight gain, your odds of improvement were reduced by 25%. And for every 10 pounds of weight gain, your odds of having substantial decline were increased by 31%. So even modest weight gain was associated with lower odds of pulmonary function improvement and increased odds of substantial decline in pulmonary function, even after controlling for smoking. So the take-home lesson from this is that in looking at pulmonary function after acute exposure, you need to consider the effect of weight change. Now, this is not really super novel in the sense that people understand that weight is associated with pulmonary function. However, and in fact, in the prediction equations that the NHANES researchers developed, you find weight being there. Unfortunately, we don't have good longitudinal prediction equations, and this is kind of novel in that we are actually showing that longitudinal weight change is associated with change in pulmonary function, and we actually have another paper. We're actually working on some other research that shows this as well. So that is it. I thank you to everyone who has worked on this, and including Dr. Weber. I see Madeline Rosprink, who's in the back there, who's did actually most of the data analyses for this. I thank her for that. And I always, in every talk, I remember the 343 who died on September 11, 2001. Thank you.
Time for questions. Would you prefer to take questions now or after your
second talk? Now's good, because the second talk is on a different subject.
Okay.
It wasn't that comprehensive, was it? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm curious, when you interview someone for a study,
mm-hmm.
Do you give them the results? Do you tell them what the outcomes are? And second part is, are they willing to allow you to do all the things you do to them, whatever they are?
Everyone in this cohort signed research consent. And what's our research consent? It's well over 90%.
It's over 90%.
I think it's over 95%.
It's different for physical and mental health, but...
Yeah, but for this, it's very, very high. So this is a group that's willing to contribute to research, at least for physical health.
But they're not interviewed. So we're an occupational health cohort.
Oh.
And they come in for their routine surveillance exams every 12 to 18 months. They answer questions in the surveys, mm-hmm. but they also have blood pressure and weight
right.
and height. All those things are measured as part of their routine occupational health exam. That's where the data comes from.
And if they score, if their pulmonary function is too low, they're going to find out because they're going to be declared unfit for duty by the physician. So it's in their interest to stay healthy.
Right.
Now the standards for getting in the fire department are not quite as high as staying in the fire department, but if your pulmonary function, and unfortunately many firefighters have been forced into disability retirement as a result of the 9/11 exposure.
Because of your tests or because they decided to do it?
No, because they come in, they can't, they don't have enough lung capacity to work as firefighters anymore.
Nice. So it's a good thing.
Well, it's a bad thing that people are having to retire who don't want to, but you don't want someone with 2 liters of pulmonary function running up a burning into a burning building to try to carry you out. Yeah.
So I'm not up on the literature about World Trade Center exposure. So my question was going to be, so you know, you described that weight gain was affected with a decrease and
mm-hmm.
Increase. So how does this group who has been exposed at World Trade Center compare to another group of similar workers, similar firefighters who didn't have exposure?
That's a fabulous question, and NIOSH actually has a firefighter study in which they've published a cancer study, and I'm hoping to convince them to look at pulmonary function as well. We'll be talking about that. What you need to do that for a comparable occupational cohort is to have a fire department that has that does regular pulmonary function testing, that keeps track of pulmonary disease diagnoses, that also has electronic medical records going back long enough to be a comparison. So I'm not certain that that exists, but if there is, I'm going to find out, and I'm bound and determined to try to do that comparison. But we need to find that out. In theory, if the records are paper, you could abstract them, but when you've got thousands of medical records, the cost would become probably prohibited. But that's a great question. This is not a normal cohort.
Right.
Yeah.
You have some data that you could look at. Is weight gain or weight loss associated with either indirectly or directly the exposures at 9/11, namely post-traumatic stress?
Mm-hmm.
Has that been looked at?
That's a great thought.
No.
We haven't looked at that.
We have the PTSD.
We looked at PTSD, but not in function of weight gain.
I don't think that we looked at it as a function of weight gain.
That's good.
That's interesting.
Yeah, sure. So I was saying it's a good idea. We have PTSD data, just the screening data, and we have weight gain and weight data change over time. So we could look at that, but we haven't. There are national data, though, on age-related norms by race and by gender. And we have done some comparisons, but it's flawed because for the healthy worker effect that we all know about, and firefighters are indeed very healthy. So it's not perfect. But certainly we see greater age-related decline we see more than age-related decline
mm-hmm.
In our cohort, more than the expected decline
yeah.
that everyone would have over time.
Actually, just to be precise, we had hugely more than age-related decline from immediately before to immediately after.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, the decline has been close to what you would expect with age.
Yeah,
it's just they didn't get back to where they were. So they got about 10 years worth of age-related decline in a matter of days, and it has not come back, which we had hoped. Mm-hmm. And that's...
What about the improved, the 13% that were improved?
So we're interested in them. As you can see, well, one factor, it doesn't explain all the variability, but one of the factors is they didn't gain weight the way the rest of them did.
In view of that, that's why I'm here, because I wanted to add to that. If there were a number of people who did not decline, as you've said, and have gotten better, it may have something to do with their breathing and the way they're breathing. And there are now studies about speech and breathing that helps open up the different parts of the body so that you could still be mobile and not gain weight because you're moving and the whole body is breathing because it has to do with blood and oxygenating all parts if you breathe properly. So if you're not breathing properly, just think. You become sedentary and then you gain weight. But if it's working, so when you said people have survived this whole experience and they are getting better, means they're doing something. Do you have any studies that go further and find out why those people are doing better, doing different kinds of breath tests?
Great idea. We have not done that.
Do it.
I can relate to that as a former junior high school clarinet player. I got the lecture from the band director about how everyone was breathing incorrectly.
I personally think that there are host factors and genetic characteristics that are powerful that we don't haven't looked at but would like to.
Yeah. It is an opportunity to really help the rest of the
people. Yeah, we're really interested in that sub-cohort that has not, that for some reason has improved. We want to find that out, because everybody declining is not interesting. The fact that some people have actually gotten better is like, what? How are they different? What did they do? Is it genetic? In which case, actually, I was going to say if you're genetic, there's nothing you knew, but actually, there might be something, because the genes that are associated with pulmonary function, many of them are known to be associated with like particular inflammatory markers. That might actually, even a genetic understanding can provide targets of opportunity if there ever, God forbid, is another future disaster like this. And firefighters face small-term disasters on a regular basis, major fires. Actually, the next talk will discuss something about how the World Trade Center exposure seems to be fundamentally different from most other kinds of disasters that firefighters see.
Great segue.
I think one more.
Did you have one more?
It was a quick question about the methodology. That one section where you're talking about excluding a certain, I would think it was about 100 plus persons who had greater than 30 pounds.
Yes, it says unique numbers. I believe the number was 101.
Okay, so.
Madeline is nodding.
Yeah.
Okay. I found it on one of the sheets of analyses, and it didn't make it into the final version. Yeah.
Okay, and you're saying it was probably due to other conditions like cancer, but what if it was intentional weight loss?
Yes, that's a good question. In theory, you might. Well, first of all, if you are that obese, you're not going to get into the fire department in the first place. That you would want to have that kind of weight loss. So the other possibility is anorexia. There might be an anorexic firefighter in the fire department, city of New York. I've never actually seen one.
Yeah.
It would be extremely rare.
Yeah.
I mean, it's worth looking to try to match the excluded individuals with comorbidities. We're pretty sure that that's I mean, some people have. Well, my wife went vegan a couple of years ago, and immediately within 3 months lost 16 pounds at a time, age 50. Two, when women are typically gaining weight because of menopause. And I was actually at a talk about effects of menopause, the way they talked about that, and I shared my wife's experience, and they were kind of like, wow, I can't believe she did that. So, but you don't lose 100 pounds by becoming vegan.
Right.